Hey guys, it's Lavetta.
And it's Miriam.
And this is the Notorious Women Podcast, a comedy podcast about some of history's most notorious women.
Yes, yes.
Miriam was just giving me a compliment on my hair.
Her hair is so pretty. Check out our Instagram because we're going to post some cute little videos and you could see.
I'm feeling myself. This
okay.
Is
my, you know. Okay. Now it's getting obnoxious. Yeah. Oh my God. You guys, she can't stop talking about herself. Okay.
Not even. I wish. I do no. not want to talk about myself these
You're the
days.
Last. You're not that person. I err on that. I'm being that person. I'll admit it. But you do not. When we hang out, when we talk, I have to be like, wait, what's going on with you?
Because it's all like, it's not bad. I remember there's this saying in mindfulness that there's nothing good or bad. Like there's no bad events or good events. There's just things that, they're just events, things that happen. And I think that's also like a tenet of Buddhism or something. And I'm just like, no, some things feel bad and some things feel better.
That's hard. I don't know. Didn't we have isn't there a lot of bad? Come on.
I don't know. Like being on a beach in Bermuda.
That's good.
Good.
Yeah. Like that sounds better. Like, I was thinking about that the other day that like, you know, money doesn't buy you happiness. And I thought, well, money could buy you a vacation and a vacation can bring you happiness. So I'm pretty sure the money can buy you happiness.
Only people who ever say that are people with money. You never hear no motherfucker who ain't got no money talking about money don't buy you happiness.
I have $50,000 in debt, but I'm so happy. No, bitch. Yeah. No, you're not.
No. No. As the wise prophet Cardi B once said, all a bad bitch need is money.
Okay? Yes. So. And she is facts. Okay. Thank you.
But don't take your advice from her on voting. So you guys get your ass out and vote.
Yeah.
These are troubling times. Like, suck it up. And listen, I'm a black woman. Ever since I've been of age to vote, I vote for usual old white man who... Yeah. It's not my knight in shining armor, not who I love everything about, but my black ass got to vote because the other one's an idiot. The other one seems, like I said, crackish, like he may or may not be on crack. And the other one's just old. So, you know, we won't get too political here, but vote, motherfuckers.
Listen.
And if you don't vote, or if you're like, they're both the same, fuck you. And I don't want to hear you complaining. Keep that shit to yourself.
Listen, there was a great meme if you watched Lord of the Rings, which is with Saruman and you shall not pass guy. Oh my God, Ian McKellen. I forget. But you know, the good wizard, the white wizard. And they're both Gandalf. I literally just watched all three movies. So the fact that I cannot remember Gandalf sad. Yes. Point is, it's both wizards, both old white men who sometimes forget things. They are not the same. Okay. My voice is like, hi.
I know. It's so frustrating because we're like, we're not excited about politics in general, but we got to do our civic duty. But someone made a very good point. It's like, in the primaries last time, we gave you the rainbow coalition on the Democratic side. You had a black woman. Mm-hmm. You had a Asian man.
Yeah.
You had black men. You had all kinds of people. And you know what people settled on? The old white man. That is the choice that we have. Okay.
I didn't vote for him in the primaries originally. Neither did you.
Who did I vote for? No, I didn't either. I think it was
Elizabeth Warren,
I think.
Yeah.
Because I like what she had to say. because she was rightfully angry at like the bailout that Wall Street continues to get, even though they will cause financial crises. But anyway, at the time, but that is the time for you guys, for the voters to choose who they want. We gave you a whole rainbow coalition, United Colors of Benetton, okay? That's an old reference, but still, look it up in the 90s.
It was good times. Okay? A lot of blocky clothing.
You had blue, black to transparent white, okay? I'm just clear. You had young, you had gay, you had straight. Listen, you had all these people. You had handsome, you had not so handsome. You had grandmas. You had women who could be models. You had all. You had them all. Okay, I don't want to hear this foolishness. Suck it up. Because if you don't suck it up, we all going to have to suffer. Okay, you know what it reminds me of? You ever seen the movie Lifeboat?
No.
So it's really good. It's an Alfred Hitchcock movie. I think it's from, it's one of the earlier ones. So I want to say maybe late 30s, early 40s.
Okay.
And in this lifeboat, first of all, this boat is huge, but it's a lifeboat anyway. And it just reminds me of, like, imagine being in the boat and, like, on one end of the boat, you see the water coming in. You're like, guys, there's a leak over here. And they're like, oh, no, that's fine. Let's just think positive. It won't matter. And you're like, I think we should plug it up. I think you should plug it up now. And then it's only until the water is like ankle level that they're like, oh, maybe we should try and do something. And then they start arguing about who is going to be the person to lead us into figuring out what to do.
Oh, my God.
And then the water gets up to our knees.
Yeah.
And then they're just like, no, in the movie is really, really good. I don't want to spoil it for you. It's been a while since I've seen it, but it's really, really good. Basically, they're trying to figure out who's a Nazi in the boat, right? And they're trying to be like, who's a saboteur? Like, yeah, it's really, really
fun.
Good.
I'd enjoy that.
It's one of those old movies. Really good. So anyway, I guess we should get started.
Probably. I like how we're like, we're not political, but vote for Biden.
I mean, listen, because it's just like, people like, I didn't get everything I want. I didn't do it. First of all, spoiler alert, I got my loans forgiven. And I did not expect it. And hallelujah. Okay. So this mess about, oh, he ain't done nothing. And he's just an old white man doing what old white men do. Okay. But he happens to stand for things that help the majority of Americans versus a small percentage of Americans who want to make the rest of us suffer for whatever reason. So just get to it, people. We have to do our civic duty. That is part of democracy. That is part of being
Google
in America. So
what is it called? Google Project 2025. Is that what they call it?
2025, baby.
You wanna live in that? No, you don't. You don't. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. So we are going to get to some murdering, hopefully, or some other kind of foolishness.
Okay.
Some uplifting stuff. Mm. I mean, that's what you get here at Notorious Women Podcast, right?
That's right.
Sometimes you get heroic and sometimes you get horrific.
Yeah. It's a coin toss. It's a crapshoot.
On that note, I believe you are first.
It's me.
This week, my darling.
Okay.
Yes. So.
So this week, we lost a very amazing, surprising woman. So it won't come as a surprise to you. We know when she passed because it was a couple of days ago.
Ooh.
Dr. Ruth Westheimer. Okay.
Of course, Dr. Ruth.
Now,
I know nothing about her, I think.
No, you don't. And neither did I. Because as I was researching her, I was like, what? Really? No idea. So it's really interesting because she definitely kept like her personal history, her personal connections very separate from her public world and from her job, which I think is something, you know, we could learn from. You and I can't learn from that. It's too late.
We're a lost cause.
Yeah, it's over. It's over. But, you know, time of place.
Yeah.
So Dr. Ruth, she was born Carola Ruth Siegel in the small village of, I'm going to guess because it's Germany, so I think I can, Wiesenfeld. I might have butchered that, which is now a part of Karlstadt Main in Germany, June 4th, 1928. Okay, so the beginnings, her childhood, very, very sad. Jewish, born in 1928 in Germany, it's inevitable, effectively. So from the age of one, she lived in an apartment with her parents and her paternal grandmother, Selma, who was a widow. She was given an early grounding in Judaism. Her father took her regularly to synagogue, which was not always going to be the case in, I happen to know, for girls, for a father to take his daughter to do that, which, you know, I was like, good on him for recognizing she's, you know, she needs this education and blah, blah, blah. So, November 1930. So she talks about how she actually had a lovely little childhood up until then, that in 1933, Hitler was voted to power. And they started taking away things from Jews, you know, like the, all these warnings we see like that, that started happening. Right. But in her memory, she was fine. Her parents, and what I know as a parent, her parents protected her effectively, which I think is wonderful. And I think effectively helped her become the person she became. Right. Because she was like, I actually had a lovely little childhood. 1938 was Kristallnacht, which, I don't know if you know, it was a very famous, it's called the, it's the Night of Broken Glass, where the Nazis, they burned down basically like 10,000 Jewish stores, Jewish homes, all the synagogues, anything connected to anything Jewish they destroyed. And a week later, her father was taken by Nazis. She never saw her father again. It's very sad, but it'll, we'll uplift in a moment. I swear, you guys. So this is very sad. Her grandmother apparently handed the Nazis money and pleaded with them to please take good care of my son. Those fuckers took her money. Those motherfuckers. Anyways,
of course they did.
So her mom and her grandmother decided to put Ruth on the Kinder transport. So Kinder transport was a thing they were doing for a while in the 30s before the war broke out, where they, you couldn't save anybody. They were trying to save children. And so they were putting these kids, Kinder transport, on trains to England, to Switzerland, to different places. So she was sent on a train to Switzerland. Now, it was January 1939 that she went. She did not want to go because she is 10.
Yeah, of course.
And
not. Yeah.
I read this in Wikipedia, and I don't know if this is true, but I read that she was never hugged as a child again. But I mean, it's a lot of kids, but she arrived at the orphanage. She was one of 300 Jewish kids. Some were as young as 6. And by the end of the war, most of them were orphans, including her. Now, while she was there, she was given cleaning responsibilities, and she took on the role as like caregiver and a mother-like figure to younger children. The girls at this orphanage were not allowed to take any sort of classes or get any sort of education, but there was a boy at the school that would secretly loan her his textbooks at night so she could read them in secret, and she continued her own education because she's a badass. That's right.
And I just want to interrupt here. If you don't know what Dr. Ruth looks like, she was a tiny, tiny woman. So I can only imagine, as a little girl, she was a tiny, tiny little girl.
She must have been so small.
Oh my God. So cute. Yeah.
And she talks about how she lived for years with irrational guilt that she, in her head, she could have saved her mother and her grandmother if she had stayed.
Of course.
And then later,
she's a little one. Yeah.
Right? She realized that the sacrifice that they made by sending her away. Can you imagine a world without Dr. Ruth? I can't.
Right. And also, I can't imagine the terrible decision to send a child, your child, away.
Oh my God.
Like, I can't even, and I'm not talking about Sophie's Choice. Look it up. Look at that movie.
Yeah.
It is a brilliant performance, that movie, but by the end, you're going to be mad. you're going to be like, this is some bullshit.
Yeah. I'm going to be very mad.
but the idea of like, sending your child off and how desperate you must be to like, cause you don't know where they're going, but you're like, it's better than here. So yeah.
You know, what's interesting. The tiny taste of it that I get, it's so tiny. I currently have COVID. I'm going to be honest with y'all. Getting better. I'm fine. I'm day like 5, whatever. We're in separate houses. Don't worry about it. Actually, we're in separate states right now. Point is, when I have it and my child doesn't, I don't let my child near me. I put a mask on my child. I put a mask on me.
Right.
And I say, go away. I'm not hugging you. And that sucks.
Right. Because the child is like, what? What I mean, they're old enough to know when, oh, I don't want to get like, mommy's cooties.
Yeah.
But
my kids are like, did you say more video games? That's what I just heard.
But, I know, right? Yeah. Like, it's like, whatever. I'm going to play my games.
But even that, right? This is hard.
Yeah.
Okay. So World War II ends. She's about 16 and she immigrates. She immigrates. Yeah. That's a
verb.
Yeah,
immigrates. Yeah.
To what is at the time British controlled Palestine. So 16, I need a ride to school when I'm 16, but she's immigrating to Palestine. Okay. So it's September 1945. And when she was 17, she joined a kibbutz. So she gets there and she settles. And then she's about 17. She joins a kibbutz and she changes her name from Carola to her middle name, Ruth. And this is where Ruth begins. Okay. Now, this is totally a side note and should have absolutely nothing to do with her story and not usually something I would throw in as I share. But this is a quote. The first time she had sex, what? Was, quote, first had sexual intercourse on a starry night in a haystack without contraception, end quote. Now, she then later tells the New York Times that, quote, I'm not happy about that, but I know much better now. And so does everyone who listens to my radio programs, end quote. Now, I'm jumping ahead because radio programs, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's really interesting when we find out later what she becomes of her.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know. That's why we're here, to find out all the oddball moments. And I had to throw it in there. More fun facts. She joins the army in 1947. Now, Ruth, remember she's a tiny? She, okay, y'all, I'm small. I'm 5 feet tall. Ruth is 4'7". She's tiny. So they trained her as a scout and a sniper. So Dr. Ruth was a scout and a sniper. Okay. She never killed anybody. She wants that clear. Okay. But she knows how to do it. She became so good. So she learned how to assemble a rifle in a dark when she was 90 years old. This is totally a side note. She demonstrated that she was still able to put together a Sten gun with her eyes closed. Okay, don't mess with Dr. Ruth.
I just can't imagine.
Right?
Dr. Ruth putting tight with those tiny little hands.
Oh, wow. I know, right? Listen, I've been watching The Amazing Race a lot. I said I had COVID. I have nothing else to do. And old ones. And I just see all these things. And I'm like, come on, hit the target. Come on, put the bike together correctly. But I know that I'd fuck it up. And I would be the first team to go. And my poor husband would be like, you idiot. You idiot.
And that's one of the best reality shows ever. It's like, because you don't think it's that compelling, and then you watch it, because most of us is like, I could do that, and then it's like, can I do that under pressure? No, I don't think I could do half of that stuff.
And then, like, and then I'm like, yeah, I'm totally so bungee jumping, jump off of something 600 foot onto rocks. Yeah, I could do that. It's fine. Totally my character.
That's such a good one to binge.
I know it is.
Yeah,
I started from the beginning. I have 20 years to go.
Yeah.
Point is. Okay. So on her 20th birthday in 1948, she was seriously wounded in action by an exploding shell during a mortar fire attack. The explosion killed two girls right next to her, and she was temporarily paralyzed and had two injured feet. One foot was actually missing a top portion, and she spent months in a recuperative ward before she could walk again.
Wow. Yeah.
That's why we don't know Dr. Ruth, but we do now.
Yeah. Wow.
So in 1950, she's 22, she moves to Paris. There, she studies psychology under the psychologist Jean Piaget. I think I said that right. Okay.
Piaget is a famous French designer.
Is it really? You would know these things. I'm is it Old Navy or Gap? Okay.
Gap is better.
Yes, always.
I used to work for the Gap.
Yes. Yes, so did I. Did we have this conversation?
But it's owned by the same company.
Yes.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, we both work. I work at
Gap.
And then
Banana Republic is better than the Gap.
Yes, but Banana Republic is something like $72 for a t-shirt. So I can't.
Yeah.
I walked in and I walked right out.
Listen, that discount though, that employee discount.
Yeah, girl.
Is banging. It was banging back then.
I don't know what it is now, but at the time, I basically left every shift with a new outfit.
Yeah. Basically, if you're working part time, you're like, why am I spending all my money?
Yeah, it was like a college job and I had like three other jobs too. Yeah. And so I was like, wow.
It's so great.
It was good.
Yeah.
I miss it. I mean, I don't miss it. I miss the discount.
No, I don't. I don't miss retail at all because people are assholes.
You know what sucks? I worked for the Gap in college. I moved to New York. Totally a side note, you guys. This has nothing to do with anything. And the Gap in New York City would not hire me. Okay. Why?
No.
Right? But the fact that we've said the Gap so many times this episode means they should sponsor us. Cool.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, we did wear those clothes.
We did. I think I might be wearing those clothes right now, Ongar.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, what is this, by the way? But no, Piaget is like, yeah.
Okay. French I learned something designer. Every day. So she earned her undergraduate degree there, despite the fact that she did not graduate high school, and good on them understanding her situation. She then taught psychology at the Sorbonne. Okay. Now, right? Because she's so good, you guys. She was married three times, but I know absolutely nothing about her first two marriages. So we'll just like,
yes, she was married three times. Yes, she was.
Yes, queen. Get you. Okay. She talks about this as that each of her marriages did play an important role in her relationship advice later on. But her third marriage, she considers her real marriage.
Okay.
And like, good on her for knowing to walk away from those first. Be like, yeah, no, I gotta go.
Yeah, I feel like that was unusual to be married that many times back in the day.
It was. But if you think about like her, she didn't have family. She had no great aunt to be like, Ruth, what are you doing? You know what I mean? Right. She had nothing. So she
vet the young man, right? You know?
Like, or to, you know, like all the people that like really like are like, what are you doing? We're gone. So she had to just marry a couple of duds first, you know?
Yeah.
But one of those duds did help her make a child. And this child is great. So... Cool. 1956, she's about 28. She has a newborn daughter. Her name is Miriam. Okay. I'm basically Dr. Ruth's family. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she immigrated to the US. She settles in Washington Heights, New York City. I will not sing in the Heights right now. I know you're looking at me like I'm about to, and I want to. We don't have the rights
counting
for it.
Five, four, three. No, we don't
in
have the rights
heights,
for it.
I think it dies and start my day. See, the trick is to not hit any of the notes. That way they can't sue you. Okay. So, obviously I could hit every note perfectly. I'm making a choice. Okay. So she worked as a maid initially for 75 cents an hour, later a dollar an hour, which is PS around 11-ish dollars today, to put herself through graduate school. So she earned her MA degree in sociology at the New School in 1959. She had a scholarship. She was a single mother at the time. She did it all.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
How did she get to the U.S. from France?
She just went there.
Oh, okay.
She wanted to get her degree in sociology at the New School.
Okay,
I think
so
that was the goal.
All right.
Okay. And so there's one source said that the Jewish Family Service paid for childcare while she worked and went to school. Another source said that that she traded off childcare with a neighbor to help each other out.
I guess a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to point out that she was able to be badass and do it all her own because she had help. I mean, I always like to point those things out.
Yeah. Everybody needs help. Everybody needs help.
Everybody needs help. Yeah. Okay. So her marriage to Fred, this is marriage number three, the real one. Okay. Westheimer, Dr. Ruth Westheimer. So she met him on a ski tow in the Catskills. Now, if that isn't the most Jewish meet cute I've ever heard of. I was going to say,
that is...
Yeah, you were
waiting for
me to say
it. I'm glad she found her people, though, when she got to the States. I'm glad she found her people.
Yeah, I think that... And he was a survivor as well.
Oh.
And they had...
Yeah. This is so sweet. I can't...
But come on, a ski lift in the Catskills. Oi! I'm writing it right now.
Oh, my God. That is so cute. I cannot stand it.
Hello, my Ruthela. Yes. Fred. Okay,
oh,
sorry.
Fred, yes. Yeah, oh, yes. Yeah.
So he adopted Miriam. What a great name. And then they had another baby named Joel. They, aww, P.S., married in 1961. So she became a U.S. citizen in 1965. P.S., I didn't know this was a thing. In 2007, she actually regained her German citizenship because there was a German citizenship project that allowed descendants of Germans who were deprived of their citizenship because of the Nazis to get it back without losing any sort of citizenship of their current country. So she was still an American, but she was able to. I feel like that's probably just an emotional way of connecting to
your
childhood, you know. Okay. Yeah. 1970. She's 42 years old. People still have not heard of her. Okay. She receives her Doctor of Education in Family Life Studies from the Teachers College, Columbia, with the help of a scholarship, studying under Shirley Zussman. Then she trains as a sex therapist at the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center, Cornell Medical School, working for another 7 years under sex therapist Helen Singer Kaplan, which she trained under her for 2 years and then spent 5 years training others with her. So she gets her doctorate. She briefly works for Planned Parenthood in Harlem, training women to teach sex education. And this experience encouraged her to continue studying human sexuality.
Yeah, it did.
She's badass. So she went on to work a postdoctoral researcher at New York Presbyterian. She continued there as an adjunct associate professor for 5 years, and she also had a little private practice as a sex therapist on the Upper East Side. Now, 1980, she's 51, 52 years old, and she gave a lecture to New York broadcasters, right? Like radio, about the need for sex education programming to help deal with issues of contraception and unwanted pregnancies. Betty Elam, the community affairs manager at WYNY, was impressed with her talk, offered her, $25 per week to make a show. Doesn't that remind you of the theater stipend you got when you did a show
in
New York?
This is like public radio,
here's
public
a metro
access,
card.
Kind of. Yeah, basically.
So it started as a 15-minute show, which aired every Sunday at midnight, which historically was like a dead time. Nobody listened anyways.
Yeah.
It was called Sexually Speaking, and she would answer questions by listeners. The show eventually became nationally syndicated. Okay.
Yeah, it did.
By 1981, it attracted 250,000 listeners every week. The network didn't even promote it. They just found out and everybody listened.
I wonder how that happened.
So then it became an hour long on Sunday nights that started at 10 p.m. It was picked up by 90 stations across the United States. It ran for a decade. It talked all about sex. All the things. I'm not going to go into details because y'all know what all the things are. And if you don't know, you should maybe read her book. She writes it later. Okay. The New York Times described it as one of the station's oddest shows and among its biggest draws. A New York University professor of human sexuality made listening to her show a class assignment. By 1983, her show was the top-rated radio show in the country. And in 1984, NBC began syndicating the radio program nationwide. She became a producer.
Okay.
I want to say obviously, but like...
Yeah, but that's not always true.
Not always.
It's not always. And also, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think we have to drive home the fact, if people aren't familiar with Dr. Ruth... She was a tiny, tiny lady with a very distinctive voice, but she also was very grandmotherly.
Yes.
By the time she became really famous.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that she was sex. Like 52, because I was like,
I know.
Weren't you 97? You know, like, because
I thought she was like in her 80s. Yeah. Like,
no,
yeah.
You have to do, you got to listen to. One journalist, yeah. In fact, this is good. One journalist describes her voice as a cross between Henry Kissinger and Minnie Mouse. And that's pretty good. I'm going to go with that. That's pretty good.
Yes, because I don't want to try and do her accent for fear of insulting someone or being like, but it was like a high voice, but she had these little glasses and like a very conservative haircut.
Yes.
And it's like your grandmother talking about the female orgasm, and you're just right. Like, what?
And I want to say, she was so, you guys, what was amazing about her, especially like, I always feel like the world somehow balances, and she balanced out the 80s, because like, it became such a prude decade with Reagan and his bullshit and like, you know, conservatism taking over. But she was like, a woman should have an orgasm. I don't do her accent well, but I love it. You know, like, She approved every sexual fantasy. If you want to imagine, she said, if you want to believe the whole football team is in bed with you, go for it. You know, like, masturbation was great. Like, apparently someone asked about her about having sex with an animal, and she would go, I don't know, I'm not a veterinarian. Because she's basically like, yeah, don't do that.
Oh. Okay. Right. But she would take the question seriously.
Yes.
And
she would.
I mean, I know in politics, things were conservative, but in the streets, cocaine, greed is good. Decade. Like, people were getting it on.
That was Griselda's porn. Like decade, you know.
Yeah. Like, porn was on like
fire.
Like local access channel. And then like, I listened to this other podcast, which I think you guys should definitely listen to. If you like this podcast, you'll like that. You Must Remember This. And Karina Longworth is a historian. And she has like these different series, and she covered like the 70s and the 80s in music and films and 90s. And I hadn't even thought of it, but she was talking about how like Deep Throat came out in the 70s, and like how you had like, it was the first film that was like in non-porn like things. And then how like the 80s was so sexual. So when you watch movies from the 80s so much, like, you're like, why is there like just like rampant nudity in places that shouldn't be nudity in a film? Like,
because society's gonna balance it out, man. They just are, you know.
Yeah. And there was Dr. Ruth, this little bespeckled grandmother.
She believed in contraception. She believed in abortion. If contraception doesn't work, she was very like it. And you guys, this wasn't political. It was That's the thing you need to do. She wanted sex. She thought everyone should have sex. Her tag phrase was, get some. Yes. Okay.
Hey, I mean, yeah.
You know, she also talked about like, it's better to be in a relationship than to have a one night stand. Like, she had her ideas, but she also was very in favor of Planned Parenthood. Research for AIDS. Remember, this is the 80s. She wasn't, you know, she was very honest. You know, she also spoke out against any sort of sexual practice under any sort of pressure. Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. It has to be consensual.
She was a badass. So in 1984, she began hosting several television programs on the Lifetime TV network. We need her back. Her first show was called Good Sex with Dr. Roost Westheimer. And she ended,
I think, for me.
Did you ever see it? I don't think I saw it.
No, I think you know how I became aware of her? I think it was like on Oprah or something. Like wasn't, I didn't watch her show, obviously. Like, but I became aware of her that, and then, you know, she started doing the syndic, and then maybe I started watching her show. But
I mean,
I just remember
bits of it, and I was a
kid.
Yeah. Like,
and it was very educational. Yeah. Like, I feel like it didn't feel, I don't want to say clinical, like, it just felt like, oh yeah, sex is natural. It's not some dirty, dirty thing. It's natural. And here's like information about like orgasms, about contraception and like all this kind of stuff. Like it was very like informative. So I think that's what. And then again, it comes in this package of like this tiny, tiny lady with this voice who looks like a grandmother.
You have to like, oh my God, I love her. So she has this, it was called, it changed it to like the Dr. Ruth Show. It expanded to a full hour. The 2 million people watched it every week. She appeared on the cover of People. She was, she acted in a movie, Une Femme au Deux. I think okay. I saw it, starring Gerard Depardieu and Sigourney Weaver. A game, Dr. Ruth's Game of Good Sex. It was the distributor of this game compared it to the distribution of Trivial Pursuit. It was so popular. Okay.
Oh.
There was also a video game in like computer land.
No.
Yeah, for like the Commodore 64 and the Apple II.
She was a cultural phenomenon, yes. Like much like Richard Simmons, R.I.P. Richard Simmons.
I love Richard Simmons too.
You know, or like Mr. T, or like anything like you can think of, like culturally, Cabbage Patch Dolls, like you know.
Yeah, like if you're like, gonna like list the 80s, like she is on there, front and center, absolutely.
80s and 90s, like 80s, you know, she was around. Yeah, yeah. So,
and she had other shows. She was also like guesting on a couple of different like TV shows at the time. There was an ABC sitcom pilot, Dr. Ruth's House, which was just a one-time special and did not move forward. That was the only thing I read that was like not, that didn't like work. Listen, in 1995, she hosted a series of Playboy instructional videos entitled Making Love. Okay. And let's get biblical. Can we get biblical for a minute? Okay.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
1996, she co-authored the book Heavenly Sex. Okay. It's on Judaism and sex. You notice I'm interested, right? Okay. In which she wrote, quote, the great Rabbi Simeon ben Halefta. I probably said that wrong. I am so sorry to my entire family. This is interesting, and this is why I'm talking about it, because we have to dissect this. Called the penis the great peacemaker of the home. End quote. Now, I think that that's worthy of Lavetta and Miriam having like a little conversation.
Listen, I'm going to put it in vernacular, Ebonics.
Go for it.
A-A-V-E, as we say nowadays. Basically, she's like, get that dick and you gonna have peace in the house. Get that dick, girl. Get that dick. If that's your thing now.
Oh my God. Like, right, if that's your thing. Right.
That, yeah.
The great peacemaker and then in also, many homes, but not all.
And also giving that dick
right
brings harmony to the home.
It sure does. Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, she ain't wrong. She ain't wrong. But but then, this is weird coming from this lady who looks like this and sounds like this.
The great peacemaker of the home. Like, oh my God, Dr. Ruth, I love you. She also refers to the, so she's basically going to the Bible and is like, yeah, yeah, good sex is in here. Let me pull out.
Right, right.
So she refers to the book of Ruth, get it? But it is,
yeah,
right? As encouraging single women to initiate sex. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, of course, with men who you will later marry. Wink, nudge, nudge, you know. And then like, and other things. But I just thought that was like, yes, girl. Yes, girl. A lady needs to be pleased because the Lord says so. Okay.
Yeah, because straight ladies out here, we getting the short end of the stick most of the time, and pun intended. Yeah, like I heard it.
Yeah,
because the Rainbow Coalition, the LGBTQ+IA, they getting it in, and they having way better sex than we are. I'm the so straights sorry. Are. That's why I think the straights are so angry because they're not getting laid enough. Basically, that's what you she was what? Saying. Y'all need to get laid enough. No, y'all need to get true. Laid more.
If every white lady who voted for Trump had an orgasm were on the regular, I bet you they changed their mind. I'm just throwing it out there.
I mean, that's what she's saying. Like, get it in.
You know.
Yeah.
Okay. Then in the 2000s, she actually did more than I realized. Like, so she was on a PBS children's television series, Between the Lines, as Dr. Ruth Wertheimer, as which she helps anxious readers and spellers overcome their fear of long words. How cute. Okay.
Oh, that is cute.
There's more. She was on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She was on Live with Regis and Kelly. January 2009, the 55th anniversary issue of Playboy included her as number 13 in a list of 55 most important people in sex from the past 55 years. Vanity Fair named her one of 12 women who changed the way we look at sex, etc. Now, in her final years, she lived in a cluttered three-bedroom apartment on 190th Street because that's where she felt her home was. So if you think about, this is where she raised her babies. She has mm-hmm. billions of dollars. I mean, I don't think it's billions, but she could live anywhere and go anywhere.
Where does she live? You said Washington in Manhattan Heights, on
190th Street.
190th
it's
Street.
It's a nice area. Yeah, well, it's a very nice area.
Also, what, every New Yorker knows, no matter how much money you have, you find a place that's big enough for your life. You don't fucking move. You just make it nicer.
You just make it nicer. You expand. Yeah. You know, buy the apartment next door.
Yeah. You do not fucking give up real estate. I mean, she think of her background, but I understand it. Having lived in New York for a period of time, a lengthy period of time, I do understand that because it's a different thing. Like if you've never lived in the city, you don't quite understand it. But if you ever lived in the city, you're like, yeah, you find a good place with good bones. You don't give that up. Cause
yeah, no.
You don't know how the other building's going to be. I actually have a good friend who
has an apartment in Washington Heights. She was able to buy it and then she renovated it. Like, this is her life. This is her whole life.
Yeah, so I get it.
I do want to mention before we go, because I feel like it's appropriate now. Her granddaughter talks about how after the election of that orange horrible man in 2016, her granddaughter would call Dr. Ruth, her grandma, probably Bubby, I don't know. Actually, I'm lying to you because Dr. Ruth would call her every day to see how she's holding up. And she said her grandmother's belief that, quote, everything will be okay, reassured her. And I just think our country needs Dr. Ruth's love too. Quote from Leora, she reminds me that we live in a big country. There are many people who are just as upset as I am. And now, more than ever, we need to stand up for what's right. So that's what Dr. Ruth said. So we can take that. And she talks about her. So her son, Joel, tweeted about her a few days before her 92nd birthday to showcase a photo of her attending a vigil in New York. And she is seen holding two signs while masked. Okay. That read, enough is enough. And Black Lives Matter. 92, she went to that.
Yep.
This is a badass bitch. I love her so mm-hmm. much.
You and me both.
And she died July 12th, 2024, at the age of 96.
She just died, Dr. Ruth.
I just feel like it's too soon. And I understand that she's 96.
But 97, a child of the Holocaust, lived to be 97. Yeah. Her parents' sacrifice was worth it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if I could say it's worth it, but that is what they would have hoped.
That's what they
for, right?
As a mother, it was worth it. That's what you want, you know?
That is what they hope for, so she did them proud.
Yeah, she did.
Thank you so much for sharing Dr. Ruth. You guys go and look her up. She's awesome.
You guys, I'm going to post so many videos of her talking about sex. You have no idea. Check out our Insta. I'm so excited.
Thank you for that. My Notorious Woman this week is also inspired by current events and what's just happening in general, what's happening now. She's not a murderess because I, I love a murderess, but she's not. But she
boring.
She, yeah. She stab, stab, stab. But anyway, So my Notorious Woman this week is Louise Jenkins Merriweather, actually. Okay. And so I was inspired by her because of what just happened this past week. The may or may not have been assassination attempt on. who knows, Lord? Let me move on.
Listen, we know what the headlines were. Based on those headlines, go on.
Yeah. But people started posting on Twitter, especially, the most hard picture ever, right? And it's just like, okay, no, it's not. So then people will post other things that counter, you know, answering that. And one, which actually started circulating during George Floyd protests and, you know, and the murder of George Floyd in front of all of our eyes, and then the protests that came and in the wake of it, this black woman in, it looks like a raincoat, being flanked by like National Guards. And she's like, looks like she's finishing her cigarette.
Okay.
she's just coolly smoking a cigarette. Old black people used to like cool, yeah. like smoke. They made old smoking used to look so cool back in the day. But like something about older, I don't know how, she probably was not that old at the time, but she's just sitting there. She looks like, she's like a secretary that's been on the job for 20 something years, but she's just sitting there like coolly smoking a cigarette, and they have these guns and they look like they're talking to her. And she's just like, so that started circulating during the whole George Floyd protest era. And people were like, who is this woman? Like, when I grow up, I want to be her, you know, like no matter what age you are. And so that is who that is. Louise Jenkins Merriweather. Okay. So I'll get into how we got to that picture, but let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
So Louise Merriweather was born on May 8th, 1923 to Marion Lloyd Jenkins. I absolutely deleted her mother's name. Dang it. Oh, what did I do?
Really?
I have to find it. I totally, you know how you're editing?
Yes.
It's okay.
She
basically
had a mother,
her parents.
Go on.
Yes, basically, I'm going to lose my black card. I'm erasing a black woman.
I'm going to stop talking.
Forgive me. Ancestors, forgive me. But basically, her parents are part of the great migration of black people from the South to the North. And this happened with her parents during the stock market crash.
Oh, yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So as a consequence of the crash, her family moved to the North and then ended up in Harlem during the Great Depression. Now, she was one of five children. Her mother was a housekeeper and her father was a janitor.
Okay.
But her father became a numbers runner. Because he couldn't find work. And so for those of you who don't know what a numbers runner is, before the lottery.
Yep.
Every different like neighborhoods, different communities throughout the country in America would have basically a homegrown lottery system. They call it the numbers. And I forget what they used to actually, the gangsters used to call it, but everybody had it. And it was one way for, particularly in the black community, for gangsters to not only make money, who they also invested in the community a lot of times. I'm not saying that they weren't doing stuff illegally, but this is a Great Depression, you know?
Yeah.
A person could hit their number and they could win like $300 or $1,000 or what have you. So so that's what numbers runners was. It's the prequel to the current day state run lottery throughout different states in the United States. So her father became a numbers runner. And basically, if you've seen the Malcolm X movie, Malcolm X was a numbers runner. And he would have to memorize the numbers in his head.
Yeah, there's a really good book about it. And I can't remember what it is.
A woman talked about her mother was a numbers runner. She was actually the house. Her mother was the number house. Like, people would come to her mother's house and put in their numbers.
Yes.
And so that kind of thing.
Yes.
And then there's also there's a great podcast called Bronzeville with Lawrence Fishburne and Lawrence Tate that also talks about it. And it talks about how, like, in Bronzeville, Chicago, the black community was running it. And then I think the Italians wanted to move in on it because it's very lucrative.
Yeah.
So, and during the Depression, crime rose, but also organized crime really prospered because of not only there's hard work for people to find. So, of course, her father had to find, he had to feed his family.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because there's no jobs. So that's one of the reasons he did it. And, you know, so that kind of thing. So that is what her, that's what happened during the Great Depression. She was living in Harlem. Now, she was a passionate reader from the beginning. So she vowed to rise above the, quote, deep feeling of shame, end quote, she felt over being in an all-white grade school in Brooklyn.
Ugh.
And she also wanted to, quote, write her way out of the wilderness, end quote.
Okay.
So that's enough. I don't think people think about that enough. When you're black in the South, like especially back in the day, you're surrounded by black people mostly. White people are kind of on the other side of town because they want it that way. And we also wanted it that way because we want to be bothered.
Right.
But then when you go to the North, the racism is different and it doesn't go away. But then you're going to school with other kids and not necessarily insulated from
it's weird because the laws were better, obviously. Yeah. You know, you weren't going to be kicked out of a school because you were black, but like you wouldn't in the South. But the culture and the community was antagonistic against you.
Yeah.
And that's hard.
And it was hard for her because she was, of the five children, she was the only girl too.
Oof, that's also hard.
So, yeah. Now, after graduating from Central Commercial High School in Manhattan, she worked as a secretary and studied at night for her BA in English from NYU.
Good girl. Smart.
She graduated college because, you know, when you, back then you had to work your way. Like most people had to work their way.
Like, can we just like pause to note how exhausted and how hard that is? Yeah. I went to college I had jobs not the whole time. I didn't have to have a job my first year of school. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I had work study jobs. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, but back then,
it's like you're working 30 hours a week and you're studying for college.
Like Dr. Ruth was cleaning houses and going to school. So now after graduating with her BA in English, she went on to earn her MA in journalism in 1965 from the University of California out in Los Angeles, where she moved with her first husband, Angela, a Los Angeles teacher by the name of Angelo Merriweather.
Okay.
Now, despite divorcing Angelo and her second husband, Earl Howe, she continued to use the name Merriweather while working professionally as a writer.
Okay.
Now, during her professional career, she worked as a freelance reporter from 61 to 64 for the Los Angeles Sentinel.
Okay.
And she has the distinction of being the first black woman to be hired as a story editor in Hollywood for Universal Studios from 1965 to 1967.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, while living in Los Angeles, she became a part of the very famous Watts Writers Workshop. It was a creative writing group initiated by the screenwriter Bud Schoenberg in the wake of the Watts riots in 1965 in South Central Los Angeles. This became like a very popular and a very famous writers group. And some of the fans of the Watts writers group were James Baldwin, Richard Burton, John Steinbeck, and Robert F. Kennedy, among many others.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So now she was always a true artist who believed in education. You know, you also need to make a living.
Yes.
But throughout her life, she was involved in numerous writing groups, including the Watts Writers Group workshop, but also including a New York based writers friends group that included Rosa Guy and Maya Angelou.
Oh, hi. Okay.
Yes. Okay. Now, of this experience, she said of the New York based writers group, She said, quote, "We partied all over. Wherever we were, we partied. Then, of course, we got our work done. We believe in enjoying ourselves and enjoying each other."
Oh, don't you want to be part of that writer's group so badly?
So I love the fact that because we talk so much, we think so much about activists being very, very serious. But it's like they were people relatively young out in the world trying to live their lives, smoking cigarettes, drinking, looking cool.
That's what... That inspires me so much because, you know, the world's a dumpster fire. It's not a secret, but it's how do you balance living the one life you have with as much joy as possible without turning off the need for society to have your good words and good thoughts, you know, to make a difference.
It's what is the old adage, work hard and play hard?
Yeah.
So. That's what, and Louise was all about that. So
now
while working with the, she is so cool. Now while working with the Watts Writers Workshop, she was actually approached by the editor in chief of Essence Magazine, which is a black female magazine. But she, to She was approached to be the editor-in-chief of Essence.
Oh.
But she declined because she said she preferred to write for them. So she began writing with her first, writing for the magazine with her first article, quote, Black Man, Do You Love Me? End quote. Appearing as the cover story for the magazine's first issue in May of 1970.
Okay.
Now, that same year, she also published her first and perhaps her most successful book called Daddy Was a Number Runner with the foreword by James Baldwin. And it's a novel that uses some parts of her elements of her life about growing up in Harlem during the Depression and in the era after the Harlem Renaissance, as seen through the eyes of a 12-year-old girl named Francie Coffin. It is considered a classic. I've never read this book. I got to read this book.
I got to read this book,
Daddy
too.
Daddy Was a Number Runner. Yeah, we got to read this book.
Yeah.
In the words of Paula Marshall, the very famous author Paula Marshall, quote, the novel's greatest achievement lies in the sense of Black life that it conveys, vitality and force behind the despair. It celebrates the positive values behind the Black experience, the tenderness and love that often lie underneath the abrasive surfaces of relationships. The humor that has long been an important part of the Black survival kit, and the heroism of ordinary folk, a most important novel, end quote. So you guys should pick that up.
Yeah.
Daddy Was a Number Runner. So, and I love how like it's very like it's in the vernacular. Daddy Was a Number Runner. Like it's not a grammatically correct thing, but that is how people would say it. I love it. So we would say that that's written in dialect. So now the novel sold more than 400,000 copies.
Oh, we need to buy it.
Now, she is publishing her first novel. And by the way, it was the first novel that came out of the group of the Watts Writers Workshop. Okay. So it was the first of many to come out of that group. Now, she's publishing books alongside Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou. So Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye was coming out around that time. And Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
Oh, wow.
All of which helped to the rise of Black women's voices in literature. James Baldwin, who, like I said, contributed the foreword to her novel, praised Louise Merriweather for telling, quote, everyone who can read or feel what it means to be a Black man or woman in this country, end quote. She was a National Book Award winner, and then also also a National Book Award winner, Jacqueline Woodson, was among many who have later credited Louise Merriweather for giving them the inspiration to write and to understand the discipline it takes to finish a novel. Because if you finish any kind of novel, even if it sucks, that is a feat unto itself. Like that is unto itself. That is amazing. So, but you know, she became a inspiration for so many authors that came after her, even though she's not as famous as Maya Angelou or Toni Morrison, both of whom I adore.
Yeah.
But so I'm like, this is a gap in my literature, knowledge. So I definitely got to check her out.
I do too. Now, I eat up so much of that era of books.
Yeah.
That I'm like, wait, what? I missed one?
Also, I just feel like it's kind of like how I feel like during the pandemic, I started watching movies from the 70s in particular. And when you watch movies from the 70s, they all feel very real. Like it's not sleek. It's not like... Some of them feel a little bit too real, but it's the cinematography, the way they shoot things from long lenses. And I don't know if that a lot of that came from blaxploitation films or the need to build a film on limited budgets. I don't know. But a lot of the movies feel very, very lived in. And I feel like literature from this period also feels that way.
Do you know why?
When you read it,
I think that's why I became sort of attracted to it. I mean, truth be told, I'm graduated college, moved to New York City. I had no money. And they used to set up these, I don't know if you remember them, like these tables all over the place with books that were like $2 each.
Yep.
And I don't know why I didn't understand what a library card was, but I didn't. So in my head, that was the only way to get books.
Well, because you're out and about too. And then you see them, you're like, oh, let me look get books.
And like, my life was like so chaotic to remember to go back to the library to return it. I would have lost it 100%. That said, support your libraries. Point is, that's how I found, I remember, I don't remember. It was an Alice Walker book that I loved and I grabbed it first and I just kept my Angelou, Toni Morrison. Like I just bought all of that air. I felt like because it was truth.
Yeah, and it feels very visceral in a lot of ways, like those films. Yeah, the visceral. And I also think because I think a lot of the artists who were making work during this time, whether they were writing, painting, sculpting, making movies, making doing plays, writing plays, I feel like that they were naturally political because there's so much shit was going on.
Yeah.
And it I think it may come out of the student movement in the 60s. I feel like that whole era, like the 60s and the 70s, it feels very real. And then we get into the 80s where everything's all slicked over, right? It's all about, I don't know if it's cocaine haze, because there's a lot of cocaine in the United States in the 80s. I didn't realize how much cocaine there was, but there was a lot.
It was a lot.
Yeah, and then all kinds of stuff. I think maybe people are like, let's party in the 80s or something. They were partying in the 70s too, because that was disco. But I just feel like the artists that were making music in a lot of ways, you know, I'm thinking of like the beatniks, right? Like, you know, the mamas and the papas or the, you know, the, you had like not only soul music, but you also had like folk music. You had like a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. And they were telling, I remember hearing Mississippi Goddam for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, and I'm a white girl growing up in the 80s. So everything was like protected and given to me with a ribbon around it. Nothing was, you know, I felt like I had to search for truth. And I remember listening to Nina Simone. I think I found her CD at the Virgin Megastore or something. I was like, you could listen to it. And I was like, ooh,
yeah,
I like the voice.
Yeah, yeah.
And I bought it. And I remember listening to the song and I was like, oh, damn. Oh, that's exactly what she's talking about. This isn't a metaphor. It's a fact. And
they're living it.
And they're
living it then. And they were able to convey it. And I think that's why it was so visceral. Kind of like what we're living through now.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
Do you think people will listen to our podcast in 100 years and be like, "Oh, it was so visceral"?
Probably not, because we are just two dorks who are just doing our best not to keep it together, keep it together, keep it together. If you get that reference, then we could be friends. Now, after the success of her first book, she began writing biographies for children about historically important African Americans, including Robert Smalls, Daniel Hale Williams, and Rosa Parks. She explained, quote, "After publication of my first novel, I turned my attention to Black history for the kindergarten set, recognizing that the deliberate omission of Blacks from American history has been damaging to the children of both races. It reinforces in one the feeling of inferiority and in the other the myth of superiority," end quote. So I love that. Like she went to like shape.
She's right.
She's naturally a teacher too. I can tell. Like, because only a person who was like, let me go and, you know, turn to the little children. So now she would go on to publish other novels, including Francie's Harlem in 1988, Fragments of the Ark in 1994, and Shadow Dancing in 2000. But from the time she published Daddy Was a Number Runner in 1970, through that she sort of turned, she became part of the Sesame Street, or like, you know, Mr. Rogers. I wanted to say Robinson because it's the Eddie Murphy version.
Mr. Robinson.
Mr. Rogers, like, and Reading Rainbow, like all of that stuff is very important in the shaping of young minds that will go on to go out into the world. So now she also wrote numerous short stories, taught creative writing at Sarah Lawrence College and the University of Houston. She was awarded grants from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Mellon Foundation, the New York State Council on the Arts, and the Rabinowitz Foundation, among many, many others. If this wasn't enough, somehow she found the time to also be an activist, because that's of the time she's coming from, yeah. right? So over the course of her life, she was involved with various organized groups for Black causes, for all kinds of causes, including the founding of the John Henrik Clark, along with John Henrik Clark of the anti-apartheid group called the Black Concern.
Okay.
The Harlem Writers Guild.
Okay.
With Vitell Whitfield, the Black Anti-Defamation Association, mm-hmm. That was formed during so apparently there was a book called The Confessions of Nat Turner written by a man by the name of William Styron. It sounds like basically it's a white guy who wanted to tell a story of a Black man, and he didn't know what the fuck he was talking about, and he was going to just... And Hollywood was like, yes, please, let's do that. And they were like, no. Shut this shit down.
God, they're stupid. So, okay.
Louise Merriweather, remember who was that was saying that years ago somebody suggested that Julia Roberts play Harriet Tubman or something?
What? Oh my God, I remember.
You didn't hear about that?
I did.
And the guy was like, they were serious. And she's like, what? Julia Roberts? And I love Julia Roberts, but no, like, I do.
She could be Harriet anyway. Tubman's white friend. That's fine.
So apparently there was some foolishness going on around. They were trying to do a Nat Turner. For those of you who don't know, Nat Turner was he led a slave revolt, and he was lynched for it.
He should be so in all of your history books.
White man was going to do the Confessions of Nat Turner.
So a white man was going to take into his little heart what Nat Turner must have been thinking. And what he might want to confess, and then write it down, and then sell it? Okay.
Yeah. She was like, no. So her and her group, they got together, and originally the group was known as Association to End Defamation of Black People.
Which is
in response to this foolishness. So she, and remember, she was the first Black editor to work in Hollywood. So she... the first Black woman to be hired as an editor. So she, with her group, they organized and they protested and they killed the project. Thank God.
Thank God.
Lord Jesus.
Because then it's they like, can hide just got and over... like, we're doing a Black project. Aren't you happy?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Like, they did Green Book in 2015, 16?
No, it was earlier.
So imagine the foolishness that would have come out in the 70s. No. So she was also an active member, an active activist in the peace movement for most of her life. In her own words, when she received, when she was the recipient of the Clara Lemlich Award for Social Activism in 2011, okay. she wrote, quote, I am a writer and also a dedicated activist, a peacenik. In New York City, in my 20s, I was chapter chairman of my union, marching in May Day parades and having rotten eggs thrown at my head. In Los Angeles, I was arrested in a sit-in against the racist Birch Society and sentenced to 5 years probation. In Bogalusa, Louisiana, I work with the Congress of Racial Equality Corps. Back in New York, I was instrumental in keeping Muhammad Ali, then the world heavyweight champion, from fighting in South Africa and breaking a cultural boycott. Fighting a match right. in South Africa. In honor of her many contributions, so she was doing the do.
Yeah.
But in honor of her many contributions to literature and social activism, in 2016, she received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Before Columbus Foundation. And it was presented to her on her birthday, which was declared Louise Merriweather Appreciation Day by the Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer to honor her literary legacy. The Feminist Press has launched the Louise Merriweather First Book Prize, which began in 2016, to lift up the debut women and non-binary authors of color.
Oh, that's amazing.
Now, so like I said, she was doing all this stuff. But the thing that interested me in her was at one of these mini protests in 1957.
Okay.
Again, you got to look this picture up. It is hilarious. There's two National Guards. And again, they're standing with their guns and they look like they're questioning her. They look like they're questioning her. But she's just sort of laid back and she's literally... smoking a cigarette. It's just like, I don't smoke, but she's just literally like, you know, smoking.
Just like,
yeah. You know, I love her so much because in that picture, she gives off the aura of the kind of woman that would definitely hide a body.
Yeah.
Of a terrible, terrible, mm-hmm. probably a man in the
man,
woods.
Man who needed to die. You. Yeah.
She yeah. looked like she would definitely hide a body with you if it was a good cause. Like, mm-hmm. that's my kind of lady. So yeah. I love her so much. She lived a long and fruitful life and actually died at a nursing home on October 10th, 2023 at the age of 100.
Yes, you lived through it all.
Yes, after being sick for a while. According to friends who, and a friend, a filmmaker by the name of Cheryl Hill, who cared for Louise and her in the years leading up to that, her health declined after she contracted COVID in 2020. So at 97, she contracted COVID.
Damn.
So that, but she lived to be 100, but she could have lived to be longer if the Rona hadn't gotten her. So
for real.
Take care of your older people. But in closing, I just want to tell you guys about a little thing that she said at 10 years earlier. So at 90,
yes,
20. So actually, no, at 87 in 2010.
Okay.
She gave a commencement speech at Pine Manor College, and she summed up her outlook in life when she explained that writing meant the willingness to draw upon the totality of oneself. She remembers criticizing a story submitted by one of her students, a Black student at Sarah Lawrence, contending that the young woman had not revealed anything about what she knew or who she was. And she told the young student, quote, she told the young student, you need to reveal more about you. And the young student replied, quote, if I write the truth, I'll be crying every step of the way.
Yeah.
End quote. Louise Jenkins Merriweather said of the student, she said, I counseled her, quote, all right, rewrite it and cry.
Yeah.
End quote. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is Louise Jenkins Merriweather, the badass woman in that photo, who is standing in front of National Guards with rifles, smoking a cigarette, like, bring it on, motherfuckers, bring it on.
What I love is that she went on to continue to fight, to continue to do her thing. Oh, my God.
100 years old. So.
Wow. I'm so glad. I have so many books to read now.
I know. Right.
Thank you.
I've been so dumb. Like, I often joke that we don't have that the aliens come to Earth, but they don't stay because Earth is the ghetto.
Yeah, no.
And one of the reasons Earth is the ghetto is because we just start reading. I feel like we've all become a little dumber in the last 10 years, or maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just in my orbit. But it feels like people are not. Maybe people are reading, but they're not comprehending, because I feel like
it could be. I don't know. Yeah. Like, I don't know, because I read all the time. I just, like, it's comforting to
me.
I'm not like, I'm also a nerd. But it makes me
so
feel
So I listen
better.
To books on tape. Does that count?
Actually, it does.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Better than not.
I'm too much of a nerd to know that it doesn't. Like, you gotta, I just don't, I haven't had time to sit down and like, read a book.
You know what? I want to plug a book right now. We were talking about books for children wherein they are seen. There is a book series. I've probably already told you this. I tell everybody. I'm going to tell all of y'all. It's called The Vanderbeekers. It is a, I don't know, age like 7 to like 47, because I love these books so much. It's about 5 biracial kids in Harlem on 141st Street. That's the name of the first book, The Vanderbeekers of 141st Street. And it's their, oh my God, it's so good. It's their like adventures. And it's, and first of all, the author constantly like alludes to all the books of my childhood, The Secret Garden, Anne of Green Gables, like all
I
of
I knew
these,
Anne of Green Gables was coming up.
I knew she would sneak right in there. but it's, what I love about it, and it's brilliant, is that it just, it doesn't push anything. You guys, if you have kids, please get these books. They are so good. They're at the library, hopefully. But they're such good stories. Like, you can't stop reading them. Like, that's what I read to the kids.
Aww.
Every night. because we can't. I need to, like, and when we're at the end, I'm like, I'm just going to finish it because I need to know what happens.
I love books about kids having adventures. Yeah. I just love it.
And,
right.
And then
just having adventures.
Because it's New York City. There's, you know, the Habib store over there. And then there's the, you know, like what people are all shape, sizes, colors, all the things, but it doesn't matter. It's not, it doesn't, like, it just tells a story. And I think we need more of that showing.
I have but one question. Mm. Are they solving crimes, mysteries?
No, it's not like a mystery situation so much as like a, sometimes a little, like you find, it's so, I can't, like a legit, I would start with one of those books because it's, you know, if you're a grown up, it's a very easy read, but it's just so heartwarming and it makes you give, like it gives you hope for the world. I know. This is not about the podcast at all. I don't care.
No, I love that. So they should read the Vanderbeekers.
There you go.
101st,
yeah, just
141st
like Google
Street.
The Vanderbeekers.
And Daddy was a number runner.
And Daddy was a number runner.
Runner.
Like. I just feel like more people need to feel seen. And it's as easy in children's literature, I think,
no,
still.
Not.
So,
yeah, so
we found one.
But that is amazing. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for sharing your story. And thank you, audience members, for showing up to show us some support. I know we have not done a couple of the reviews for a couple of the episodes because we've had to pre-record things because of vacation. So, but we will start that up next week. So please, as we wrap up this latest episode of Notorious Women Podcast, remember to follow us on all the things, but also give us a 5-star review in the Apple Store. That helps people find us. You can also support the show through Patreon. That's patreon.com/notoriouswomen. And Miriam, how else can they support the show or find us?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. You can follow us on Instagram. Please follow us on Instagram. It's Notorious Women Podcast. We're also on TikTok and YouTube, which you can listen to episodes on YouTube if you'd like. Also Notorious Women Podcast. And we have a Gmail if you have a longer thing to email us. It's notoriouswmpod@gmail.com. And that is that.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. All right, guys. We will see you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.